coming out on what's really pretty short notice, but also, of course, Crush Week, where everybody's struggling to find another minute for another paper and an exam. So I really appreciate people coming out to hear our important speaker and see the video tonight. Our speaker is Michael Hammerschlag, who's a reporter. He's written commentaries and articles for the Seattle Times, the Providence Journal, the Honolulu Advertiser, Columbia Journalism Review, Capital Times, and Moscow News Tribune and Guardian. He's also been working for quite a while with Media Channel, which has a citizens' media movement, which is very important. He is going to talk a little bit about the impact of the Vietnam War, the history of media coverage of war, particularly since the Vietnam debacle. And he will also be talking about introducing the film, which is called Weapons of Mass Deception. It was produced by Danny Schechter, and that should run about an hour, I guess. Mr. Hammerschlag is going to talk for about a half hour.
Yeah.
And I just want to also mention that the
Americans for Informed Democracy and
Ground Democratic Club has sponsored the event as well. And we'll have time for questions after your talk or after the video?
Yeah, after the video.
After the video. Okay, great. So welcome, Mr. Hammerschlag.
Hi, good evening. Tensions between the government and the press are as old as the first leader and the first storyteller, never more than in times of war. The press wants to tell the stories, good and bad, but the military only wants to tell one story. We are winning big, and we are on the side of the angels. It's a pure power struggle, one the U.S. military used to feel better losing, because the rationale for fighting is to defend freedom, including freedom of the press. Besides telling people what we're doing militarily and whether we should be, actual battle reports can illuminate or prevent blunders by providing clear objective viewpoints when everyone else is only protecting themselves. The authoritarian structure of the military, the pressure to win and appear to be winning, and the murky confusion of war brutalize the truth at every turn. Had the press been more enterprising, the disastrous World War II Anzio to Rome delays, the turning over big chunks of Czechoslovakia and East Germany to the Soviets, the Chinese entrance into the Korean War, the ruinous policy mistakes of Vietnam, and Bush's wanton war in Iraq might have been averted. Back in World War II, reporters were expected to be on the team, and that was easy, faced with the consummate evil of Hitler and Tojo. War correspondents had to submit all copy to military censors and watch it be cut to ribbons, disallowed entirely, or delayed weeks. In fact, the only conflict that didn't have extensive censorship was Vietnam, and all press restrictions today stem directly from that experience. The blanket power and freedom of the press in Vietnam was an aberration that will never happen again. Reporters could go anywhere, see anything, talk to anybody. Television was a new major force in American life, and the military accepted it as an ally, naively assuming it would display the courage and moral rectitude of what started out as a noble struggle, although all wars are singularly ugly affairs. Because the enemy was virtually invisible, the pictures transmitted were of our wounded, our dead, and our corrosive effects on the Vietnamese society. It was a murky, amorphous war, not given to the headline abbreviation that TV demands. So human interest stories about the miserable plight of the GIs predominated. Newsmen were a touch of home, of the world, in an alien, hostile place, and soldiers loved having them around, in part to imbue them with a soldier's hatred of the war, so they would go back and report what was really happening. Reinforced by reporters' own observations, that hatred was infused in them. But rather than reporters confronting stupid or monstrous policies directly, defoliation, free fire zones, resettlement, sweep and abandon, which was prohibited by bosses in New York, their stories became more and more downbeat, with a bitter narration that conveyed the hopelessness and brutality of the war. Then came the Tet Offensive in January to April of 68, an explosive uprising in a war that President Johnson and the generals had said was under control, was being won. 80 cities were attacked by the Viet Cong. The imperial city of Hue was invaded and held for a month, Viet Cong blasted their way into the U.S. Embassy grounds and fought all over Saigon, and the remote fire base of Khe Sanh was besieged for a terrible 77 days by 30 to 50,000 North Vietnamese Army regulars. A few thousand Marines held off an army for 2.5 months, aided by staggering amount of bombing on TV every night. In Hue, the beautiful city was destroyed, shattered like Fallujah, by savage street-to-street fighting, and 6,000 people were found to have been executed or removed by NVA hit squads. The command staff of General Westmoreland had to grab weapons and defend against a major attack against Tan Son Nhut Air Base. The shock to America was immense. This war was unwinnable, hopeless. Every one of Johnson's advisors agreed. But Tet was probably the greatest American victory in the war. Everywhere the Viet Cong and NVA appeared, they were slaughtered, 45,000. They had violated the first rule of insurgency, don't come out in the open, just hit and run. They thought the South Vietnamese would come out and support them, but the South had no interest in submitting to the brutal, fanatical revolutionaries. The Viet Cong were so decimated, they were unable to mount serious attacks in cities until 1973. But these facts were never made clear by the press. Overwhelmed by the stunning images of death and destruction, of Americans holed up like rats and fighting for their lives, of an enemy able to operate anywhere, America's will to fight was broken in Tet. After it, Johnson, Nixon, and almost every general just wanted to get out. Then Walter Cronkite weighed in, "We are mired in stalemate," and Johnson quit. All the North had to do was wait. And so the mantra began. The press lost Vietnam. The media lost Vietnam. And truthfully, there's a grain of truth there. It's conceivable if the Tet Offensive had been barely covered on TV and the staggering losses of the communists emphasized and American support continued, that Vietnam might have settled down into a Korea-like partition with hostilities tapering off to a state of sporadic terrorism. History is not immutable. But to every military man and everyone trained in the military service schools, the press lost Vietnam, and they were determined it would never, ever happen again. The media would be controlled, restricted, constrained, shackled. It was to be managed. Controlling the flow of information has always been a powerful weapon in the arsenal of war. It's called propaganda. If properly applied, one can almost win without fighting. The first test of this technique was by the British in 1982 Falklands War with Argentina. I tried to go on that, but I tried to get on the task force after it had sailed. They only allowed 17 journalists on a 40-ship task force and only let two English reporters use the transmitter for pitifully abridged stories. It was amazing. They would say, "Well, we're in the South Atlantic, and that's all I can say." Although the British were outnumbered 150 to 35 by much faster planes that had twice the striking radius and were sitting on highly vulnerable ships to anti-ship missiles, they projected an air of cool determination and overwhelming power of slowly, inexorably tightening the screws, which was dutifully reported ad nauseum in the American press until it was common knowledge that the British were going to thrash the Argentinians, or Argentines, as the case may be. British naval superiority was repeatedly stressed, although since Midway, battles have been fought between planes and ships, not ships and ships. And the Argentinians had a big advantage in planes. In reality, if the Argentinians had sunk any one of four troop ships or carriers, the invasion would have been crippled. With only five Exocet missiles, which are like harpoons, they're anti-ship missiles, they sank two ships. If they had 20 Exocets, they would have crushed the British. False reports that British nuclear submarines were in the vicinity caused the Argentinians to never even send out their subs. The Argentinian pilots fought bravely, suicidally in the face of lethal missiles, dive-bombing supposedly untouchable ships, but almost all their bombs failed to explode. That wasn't reported either. The British were incredibly lucky. By the time of the invasion, the 12,000 Argentines were so demoralized by the propaganda and being cut off from resupply that they almost gave up without a fight. The lack of on-scene reports contributed to a general shoddiness of reporting across the board. The Argentinian aircraft advantage was never brought out in any analysis. Only the British line was repeated by an American press that was fully participating in the propaganda war. Choking the media worked. The next test came immediately, the 82 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Severe press restrictions prevented most stories of the systematic destruction of Tyre, Sidon, and West Beirut by shelling in the three-month siege. The Israelis killed some 30,000 Lebanese in Tyre and Sidon alone, supposedly, to drive out 5,000-6,000 PLO members in a war of their own making. But the stories that cleared military censors were of Israelis mourning their 400-odd dead. The next year, the flash invasion of Grenada, a day after the tragic bombing of 241 Marines in Beirut, happened with almost no press alarm. When a CBS News crew tried to fly in on the third or fourth day, they were buzzed by Navy fighters and turned around. It was far easier to rally a wounded country with pictures of victorious heroes on patrol rather than the dead patients of a bombed-out mental hospital. Without media, there's nobody to report the costly and tragic blunders, so they can be avoided, or so those responsible pay the price. In Grenada, the Army, Navy, and Marines couldn't talk to each other because the radios were on different frequencies. The medical students that were the ostensible reason for the invasion weren't found for 4 days.
While 800 Cuban militia and workmen and 1,200 Grenadian soldiers held off 7,000 American troops.
Leader of the Grenada invasion, Norman Schwarzkopf. As far as the war of our enemies go, they might as well not exist. Up to 1 million perished in the World War I-like trenches of the Iran-Iraq War, and we were quite content to let them annihilate each other in private. Apart from a few fuzzy shots of Mujahideen blowing up transmission towers, the Syrian-Afghan War was also barely covered, although up to 1.3 million of the 16 million were killed, and 4.5 million made refugees. And that led directly to Osama bin Laden turning his attentions to America, almost as a raison d'etre, when the Soviet Union collapsed gave up in 88. In 1989, George Bush I decided to remove the thuggish Noriega by a lightning airborne invasion of Panama, in the first Bush war to remove a rogue CIA asset. This is the second. Official reports say that about 500 Panamanians were killed, but other reports have 2,000 to 4,000 dying. I remember only a couple of news reports, because it happened in one day. Unreported was the massive blaze that consumed the Noriega stronghold slum area of Panama City and made tens of thousands homeless. By now the pattern was set. Let a few domesticated reporters in only after the fact. But showing the aftermath of battles is inherently dishonest and dangerously seductive. Reporters had incredible freedom in Vietnam because they established it early and never relinquished it. By the time of the 91 Gulf War started, the press was a broken dog, to be kept chained at a Bahrain briefing room and tossed scraps of gee whiz video of missiles flying in windows, and the almost useless Patriot scoring one of its few kills. The image of brilliant skill and tech wizardry was duly conveyed to the viewing public, backed up by the awesome 100-hour speed of the war. Our weapons could do no wrong, it seemed, but the vast majority were dumb bombs, and the Patriot was better at shooting down our own planes than incoming Scuds. Nobody reported the 91% failure rate till years later. True journalists defied their internment and commandeered jeeps with satellite dishes and phones and tried to make their way to an impossibly fast-moving battlefield. For his gonzo efforts, CBS Bob Simon was captured and tortured by the Iraqis for 5 weeks. With only 200 to 300 fatalities against 30 to 80,000 Iraqi, the U.S. military was ecstatic, excluding the press, entirely precluded blown operations and led to an almost perfect success. But incredibly, no ground-level TV images of a highway of death out of Baghdad were ever shown, where tens of thousands were immolated in an aerial shooting gallery. When asked how many Iraqi fatalities there were, Colin Powell famously said, "I have no interest in that number." What? Of course armies have an interest in that number. That's how they know if they're winning. Another page of democracy was torn from the book. Now we would kill tens or hundreds of thousands, and it would be kept secret from the American people. This goes back to Vietnam, too, with the emphasis on body count encouraged indiscriminate killing, and the overrated Teflon Powell was a direct superior in the My Lai massacre. In the current war, we aren't told the number of actual invasion deaths. Only civilians have been informally totaled. But my guesstimate was 30,000 to 40,000, since U.S. spokesmen claimed two or three times to have reduced a division, which means they killed 6,000 to 8,000 people each time. With the deaths from the insurgents' terror and battle for Fallujah and Sadr City, a British estimate of 100,000 total fatalities sounds about 10,000 to 20,000 high. So maybe 80,000 to 90,000, I think, have been killed. Let me tell you, we have an absolute right to get these official numbers, and the media should scream until they're revealed. Now we come to this war. But first we have to talk about what happened to the press in the 90s. As the right-wing surged and overwhelmed all factions, the jihad against Bill Clinton, funded by millions of extreme right money, started in 93 with the destruction of his health care program, which the vast majority of Americans wanted, and even Republicans had supported. Talk radio, in the bloviated form of Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, Oliver North, Michael Reagan, dispensed hundreds of hours a week of raw, brutal Republican propaganda, attacking and ridiculing Democrats with manifest untruths across the 1,200-station Clear Channel network. In 1994, the payoff came in the takeoff of both houses of Congress by the Republicans. Reporters tilted farther and farther right to maintain access to the Republican representatives and get on conservative talk radio and TV networks and the Republican-owned and operated Fox News. Democrats had no such platform. Although a Republican law firm had written a two-book, 97 report on Whitewater and concluded that the Clintons did nothing, there were thousands and thousands of stories about the scandal. A brain tumor-addled Jim McDougal had traded the Clintons' $400,000 stake for a $40,000 plane. In an Alice in Wonderland scenario, Puri and Kenstar used an army of agents to rip apart administration lives, all to investigate a minor sexual peccadillo so common that two Republicans in a row had to resign for it. Newt Gingrich slept with his intern. Every reporter should be forced at gunpoint to read Joe Connison's The Hunting of the President, which details the travesty that happened during that. And during that period, the president was crippled. There was supposedly a plan in 98, after the bombings of the embassy, to actually land commandos in Afghanistan and wipe out the camps, not just send a few missiles over, which is what happened. But Clinton had no political capital, unlike our current president. The contempt for Clinton was transferred seamlessly to Al Gore in 2000 by the press pool. For a year, they painted squeaky clean Boy Scout Al Gore as a liar, trumpeting minor transgressions into major perfidy, until almost every story had to prove it instead of reporting the facts. A Baltimore Sun commentary accused Gore of lying because he claimed a rally was the biggest. Al Gore's reluctance to cozy up to the press wasn't seen in the light of his exposure to the six-year Clinton witch hunt and the radioactive right-wing hatreds that fueled it. No, mild-mannered, dryly witty Al was cold. Also known as the echo chamber, the PAC phenomenon had top reporters changing Gore quotes on the front page just to prove he was a liar. George Bush, too, received no such scrutiny, although his misstatements were multiple, ignorance profound, and experience negligible. Although Gore won by 540,000 votes, the media mavens never presented it as a moral claim to victory. They never presented it at all. The number never publicly went over 330,000, except for a tiny little mention. And three incredible outrages of Florida vote theft simply weren't reported. The public was tired of the story. I broke the first big story about all the press mistakes in the 2000 election, and one of those things in Florida where they had printed a different sample ballot than the real ballot. And the real ballot had the president on one page, or on two pages, because there were 10 candidates, and the sample ballot had the president on one page and said, vote every page, vote every page. So get out the vote workers did. They went out and told everybody, vote every page. They did. They voted twice for presidents, and their vote was thrown out. And 9% of all the votes in Duval County, which is Jacksonville, were tossed out, which was 27,000 votes. How much did George Bush win by? When the 911 attacks hit, the new president was on the ropes, beset by corporate corruption, piggish tax cuts, California energy extortion scandals. Suddenly, though, the slate was wiped clean. He was our commander-in-chief, and we had to support him. After the proper smashing of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the big lies began. Saddam was linked to Osama and the war on terrorism over and over and over. Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. He had drones. He had centrifuge tubes. He had Nigerian uranium. All lies, all propaganda to justify a reckless, lunatic war against Iraq, one every security expert said was the greatest gift in the world to bin Laden, as CIA's Michael Schur said. The media simply repeated these claims with admiration that the president was staying on message. New York Times bought the word of a single gift-wrapped Iraqi pigeon and trumpeted the proof of weapons of mass destruction across the front page, after which no media venue raised any qualms. The Queen had spoken. In a stunning violation of broadcasting ethics and flex of propaganda muscle, Clear Channel held 20,000-person rallies to support Bush's wars in many cities. Doubters were shouted down and intimidated by the Yahoo Patriot rush to war. George Bush wanted to show his father he wasn't the black sheep he could be, he'd been, and could finish the job. The neo-nuts of the Project for the New American Century wanted to spread the American flag across the Middle East and secure a safe supply of oil. Rummy wanted to practice his smaller, faster war. Israeli boosters wanted to stop Saddam's payoff to suicide bombers' families. The corporations saw a gold mine of triple price, cost-plus contracting. And Karl Rove thought, if it does cause a 30-years war, Republicans will maintain power because voters trust Republicans more than Democrats in war, for some reason. Everybody had their reasons. This time, the media was to be controlled in situ, embedded and trapped within American units. There was nothing new about this, except the intentional, total identification of the reporter with the aims of his unit. And actually, the way the war was fought allowed little else. There were no embarrassing questions about the missing weapons of mass destruction, about the plethora of lies that had launched the war, not until 6 months or so after the mission accomplished Bush fly-in on an aircraft carrier that had to head out to sea to avoid a San Diego backdrop. The breathtaking criminal incompetence of the occupation was never exposed, just the decision not to stop post-war looting and secure the weapons dumps probably lost any chance for a positive outcome. Everybody involved with Bush's spoils of war had to be ideological pure, a true believer neocon who had never doubted the peerless leader. The astounding secrecy and brutality of Guantanamo and the entire POW system was allowed to fester for years without a single expose of it. Yet 54 reporters have been killed this year covering wars, some by armies of governments that really see them as the enemy, in Philippines, Russia, Chechnya. This is the highest number in 10 years as the barriers against targeting the media break down. The American press has always been a strange animal, often strong and fearsome, but when chained, quick to degenerate into a whining mob, begging and scratching for every morsel of information or acknowledgement. This is evident in the White House press corps, and war creates the same dynamics. If correspondents allow themselves to be scared off or limited in their movements or led around by the nose by PR press flacks, the veracity of their reports is totally compromised. The ease with which the press was turned into a propaganda tool in previous wars, and especially this one, was appalling. The corporate press, with few exceptions, lapped up the warm milk that the administration had set out for them and rarely peered around the corner to the nightmare of 1.4 billion white-hot Muslims, enraged at our desecration of the Vatican to the Shiite faith, at our pounding on the heart of the Arab world, and occupation of the cradle of civilization. This war has shattered American security for the next generation or two, and George Bush can't finish the job. The truth is, he never knew what the job was. War reporting isn't a particularly attractive or respectable pursuit for a professional. Yet as man's most extreme and destructive behavior, it must be scrupulously observed, if only to shatter the myths of glamour and glory that otherwise arise. In military situations, the press can only get as much authority as it demands. And it must ask the hard questions before, during, and after the war, because those questions save lives and honor that once lost can never be regained. As David Brinkley once said, any military action is ultimately done in the name of the American people. How are they supposed to know what they're supporting if we don't tell them? And nobody can tell them but us. Thanks. Now, I'm going to present show the movie. It was Weapons of Mass Deception by Danny Schechter of Media Channel Global Vision, which is a huge affiliated website, largest media website in the world, really, connected to all kinds of people through Europe. It's actually funded, or Global Vision is a Belgian company, and they're a very liberal group. This is basically examining the press's behavior in Iraq war. Danny is an interesting guy. He's a very smart guy. He was a TV reporter. He's an ABC reporter. He was a long-time reporter for many things in Boston. Runs about an hour, and then I'm going to take questions about whatever you want to talk about, the press, politics, foreign policy. Mostly I've done foreign policy stuff myself, media, some media criticism, and politics. You know, you can talk